The last time you were here, when we talked about the fifth child, you were also en route to Houston, because...
we were up for the opera.
Yes, there was going to be an opera performance that you had created, adapted. Tell me about that. How'd that go?
Well, we promoted it. It opened in Houston, and it got mixed reviews everywhere, excepting in England, where it didn't get one good review. Not one. But it, the audience liked it everywhere. We ran to 86% capacity in Houston, London, Amsterdam, and Germany. So it wasn't too bad.
What was the title?
The Making of the Representative for Planet Age.
Uh-huh. Did you do the actual adaptation?
I did the libretto with Philip. We worked together on it.
It is hard to imagine a little bit. Do you do a lot of things like that? Was that your first opera?
Yes. I've done a libretto for another one. That's The Marriages Between Zones 3, 4, and 5. But so far, nothing has happened to it. You know, it's a very expensive business putting on an opera.
I was, as I was reading African Laughter, I was looking at your credits. And you have an enormous output of almost everything, poetry, nonfiction. There's opera, short stories, novels. It would appear that this must be an obsession. Your guiding light, so to speak, is to write.
It's a very polite way of saying that I'm a workaholic. I'm a workaholic. It took a long time for me to realize that that's what I was. I have to work. It's... The idea of not working sends me into a kind of a panic.
So how do you create your day? Do you sit down every day?
No. Well, I also have all the other things I have to do, like running a house and looking after the cat and so on.
That shouldn't take that long. Cats.
And, you know, the plumbers and the roof and the... They're not self-feeding. No. I work when I can. And ideally, I mean, dream time, I would like to work every day from 8 to 12 in the morning and from, let's say, about 4:30 to 6:30. But this very seldom happens because of all the other things that one has to do.
Well, the last time you were here, you were telling me about being born in Persia, in Persia, being raised in Rhodesia with your brother on the veldt, which you thought was a wonderful experience. You told me that you went off to London, or England, to be educated in the proper way that English children are to be educated, and it was very grim, quite unlike your native Africa. I guess you can say native Africa, can't you?
I wasn't educated in England.
You were not educated in
not
England?
Not at all, no.
But in my notes, it seems to me that you did go to England and found it grim at that
point.
Oh,
I know what. No, I was there when I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. For 6 months. On the idea was that the family would go back to what was then Persia. But then, of course, the problem was what was going to happen to the children if my parents went back? Were they going to be left in a boarding school, which, of course, was, at that time, not a terrible thing to do. But my mother didn't like the idea, I'm glad to say. And my father fell in love with the idea of being a farmer, since his entire family were farmers in Norfolk and Suffolk.
Your father's family...
farmers, yes.
...were farmers. But your father actually worked in a bank, didn't he?
Yes, well, I've just recently discovered that his father was the first one to step out of being a farmer, and he became a bank clerk. And but what he actually did was to play the organ in the village church all day and all night, much to the horror and fury of his wife, who was very ambitious, and he was not ambitious. Now, this is obviously a pattern because a cousin of mine, semi-cousin, says that her father did exactly the same. He sat and wrote mellifluous, Wordsworthian-type poetry while his wife went mad, and my mother, who was a very forceful woman, was landed with a dreaming husband, my father, and my brother was totally unambitious and only cared about the bush, while his wife went mad. I mean, it's a long line of dreamy men and women going mad with exasperation.
Mm. How did your father happen to choose southern Rhodesia to farm?
Oh, well, there was the thing called the Wembley Empire Exhibition, 1924, and there was a southern Rhodesian stand on which there were maize cobs, doubtless feet long, and the announcement that you could get rich in 5 years growing maize in southern Rhodesia. And he just went, because here he could become a farmer, which is what he longed to do. But he was a very unsuccessful farmer. Never mind, he didn't mind.
It's apparent in African Laughter that the distinctions between the whites and blacks are many, and obviously more apparent now, probably, than you realize in your childhood. You led me to believe that your childhood was somewhat idyllic, but did you have any awareness at all as you were growing up about these distinct differences and the racism in southern Rhodesia?
No, because children have nothing to compare things with. There was always an uneasiness and a discomfort, chiefly because of my father, who didn't like the setup very much. And I remember distinctly the point, somewhere in early adolescence, hey, wait a minute, I was thinking, this is a very funny setup where hundreds of these people work for nothing to speak of, for such a few white farmers. I didn't know how to understand it or anything. But all this time, you see, I was reading, and I remember thinking, well, this is not unlike Dickens, I remember thinking, the contrast between the rich and the poor. But it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that I actually really had a sharp perspective on it, a real understanding that this was a lunatic situation.
What led you to leave Rhodesia?
In 1949. Oh, well, I hated the society. This white settler society was boring beyond belief, suburban, provincial. I couldn't wait to leave and to get to London, and I was quite right, of course.
It was boring, but it wasn't because you realized the extreme racism that existed then.
Oh, yes. By then, of course I did. I knew, I mean, I'd been involved for some years in combating it by then, and realized how very strongly entrenched it was, the white minority attitudes towards the blacks, because at that time, if anyone had said, roll on a couple of decades and there would be a really strong national movement fighting and that they would win, I would have found it very hard to believe, because it seemed that the whites were in there for good.
You write in African Laughter that you became what was called a prohibited immigrant.
Hmm.
What exactly is that?
Well, in both South Africa and southern Rhodesia, there were quite a few people who were prohibited immigrants and they were not allowed to go there for one reason or another. I was prohibited by Huggins himself, Lord Malvern, as he later was. He said, I'm not going to have you upsetting our natives, which is a voice from the past. I was prohibited in South Africa. I mean, I don't make too much of it. There were literally hundreds of us. Anyone who criticized the setup instantly became a prohibited immigrant. And it's only recently, 3 months ago, that I had a letter saying I could now travel to South Africa any time I wanted to.
So what would have happened? They would meet you at the border and say no?
Yeah. They did meet me at the border, and I went down to South Africa because I didn't know that I was a prohibited, you see. I landed at Jan Smuts Airport. I had a thought, well, maybe this is... And I was simply escorted back onto the plane by some very apologetic, whatever they were, CID, presumably.
With these governments at that time were extremely conservative, so I guess your politics had a lot to do with their animosity towards you. In fact, you refer to yourself, and I don't believe you were, but perhaps you were... A communist. I don't know if you were a communist in the Marxist sense, but I guess...
Oh, yes, sure, I was a communist. But I don't think that's why I was prohibited in South Africa, because I wasn't a communist in South Africa. They prohibited people whose books they didn't like. Anyone who wrote critically of them was likely to be prohibited. in southern Rhodesia, Lord Morven told me he prohibited me because he didn't like people running around upsetting their natives.
How could you be prohibited from southern Rhodesia? I mean, you were raised there.
Oh, but I wasn't born there. If I'd been born, I couldn't have been prohibited, but I was born somewhere else.
But you spent almost all of your life there. Once you are a resident or a citizen of southern Rhodesia, they can't prohibit you. Perhaps after you leave. I mean, you did leave. Obviously, you left to go to England.
Yeah.
Then perhaps they could prohibit you. But they can't prohibit you if you actually reside there, can they?
I think so, yeah.
Escort you to the border and say, leave. I don't care if you've been here 30 years.
They didn't escort me to the border, of course, because... But I understand that I was prohibited shortly after I left. No, they don't tell you these things. They sort of hint. Anyway, that isn't the point. The point is not that I was prohibited. The point was the large number of people who were prohibited, sometimes for quite extraordinarily minor reasons. It was a very arbitrary, despotic setup, both in southern Rhodesia and in South Africa. And I don't think people even now realize quite how arbitrary and almost ludicrously so they were. And it goes on. In February, a man who had been 7 years in Zimbabwe working with the poor, one way or another, and the unemployed and the homeless, was made a prohibited immigrant and thrown out, an Irishman, under the same laws that I was thrown out under.
We've had it here. We've had people in the list is a wonderful list of great writers, people like Carlos Fuentes and Graham Greene. I don't know if you were on it or not. The State Department would not allow people that they didn't think should be in this country. They just did it. I mean, there was no legislation or anything. They just did it. You could not come into the country.
Oh, well, there was a time when I had to get an amazing formula where they give you a waiver waiving your inability to enter the country. Did you ever hear of this formula?
Yes, Carlos Fuentes was able to get a waiver, and that would allow him to... I was talking to him about this. That would have to ask for a waiver each time, and then would be restricted to Manhattan or to New York City. Couldn't travel.
Oh, no, I never had that. I did have to get this waiver once or twice, and I got fed up with it, and I thought, why should I do this? And then I... went into the whole battle applying formally to put an end to this nonsense. So now it's all over.
Fuentes got a waiver, came up here one time and was followed, presumably by the FBI or whoever follows people. And it was Norman Mailer had invited Fuentes to Mailer's Brooklyn Heights apartment for dinner. But Fuentes was restricted to Manhattan. So Mailer came and picked him up, and they were followed, and they went on a wild chase, so to speak, to elude the people who were following him, simply just to go across the bridge into Brooklyn Heights. Fuentes said, what do they think I was going to do? He said, blow up a bank or kidnap somebody? He said, nothing I ever have said is as strong as what I have written.
Well, you see, we don't think in the same way that the kind of people who run these departments think, as I discovered when I was battling with your department, they just don't think in the same way. Like, organizations in England would seem the essence of harmlessness. Their voices drop an octave or two with horror and say, were you a member of... I said, you know, I can't remember. Maybe I wasn't. Now, this was a sign of my moral turpitude that I couldn't remember, and my frivolity, because this organization was so appalling, whatever it was, that I obviously didn't care. But they think in terms of, like James Bond, which very few people, ordinary people, ever do. You know, this makes it very difficult to deal with them, in fact.
Well, they're also bureaucrats, and they have to justify their existence in some form. And also, bureaucrats take great pleasure in finding power over other people. And it happens everywhere. It happens here, happens in southern Rhodesia, happens in Britain. And that's what happens.
Well, there's a kind of paranoia that goes with this kind of politics. I think some people become infected by it and go a bit crazy. What about this chap of yours, Angleton? You ever see that program about Angleton?
No.
CIA, your spy master? The man was obviously cuckoo, round the bend, and he did unbelievable damage to your spy services. You should have a look at this program. It must be around somewhere.
Well, these bureaucrats are really having a hard time now that the communist governments have collapsed everywhere. It's very hard to find enemies. You know, they have to keep scratching to do it. It's tough. I'm sure it's that way in England, too.
I'm sure. But I understand the KGB is still intact, waiting to be called to service to mankind, so I'm told.
Well, the problem is, who are we going to hate this year?
They'll think of something. Don't worry.
Back to African laughter. You had an awkward relationship with your brother, as you make very clear, in African laughter. And he and other people in southern Rhodesia would embark on what you describe as the monologue. You put those words in caps. Can you tell me what the monologue is?
Yeah, that was a 1982 monologue. That was when the whites had been defeated militarily, which really was a blow to their pride, and had a black government, which was, for them, the end. Now everyone's used to it. So it went something like this. Yes, well, those, now they're in power. They've got our country. And President Banana. What a ridiculous name. There's our President Banana in our government house, and he's keeping chickens. No wonder that so-and-so went and threw chickens food through the wire and went cluck, 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 cluck. These blacks in our government house, and they couldn't run a cowshed. This guy went on in exactly the same words from one end of the country to the other in 1982. But by 1988, when I went again, you see, that all that had been forgotten. And they had a new set of phrases which went, why doesn't President Mugabe? What President Mugabe ought to do is this. Every conversation began like this. And, of course, that's gone, too, because the country is in a very dire state at the moment. And I don't think people expect anything, certainly nothing very much from President Mugabe.
Well, you paid four visits to Zimbabwe over the years, right?
Well, I've just come back, actually, from the fifth day. It's not in the book.
The fifth visit.
I went to find out what had changed because the place changes so fast. And what is happening there now is this appalling drought. And it's a kind of siege. They're just setting it out.
Well, what's going on exactly? What did you observe?
Well, this is the worst drought, they say, in anyone's memory. And some parts are worse than others. Down in the low veld, I don't know if you imagine the map, down Limpopo and Esabi rivers, for example, there are only 8 hippo left alive out of 800 in Esabi. And you know, you don't cook up hippo in a test tube and put them back into the river. This means a catastrophic end of something. All the animals dependent on those rivers have gone. The Limpopo's dry. That is this great river. It is Kipling's a great grey-green greasy Limpopo River is dry. And you meet farmers who say that, or anybody, right down there, they go out, the animals are too weak to run away, they just fall down. The kind ones take two pistols out to shoot the animals that are not going to recover. And the birds, you know, the birds are, just the morning I left, I was watching a couple of hornbills trying to eat cypress berries. They were dying of hunger. They would take the cypress berries into their beaks and let them drop, try again, and then they very slowly flew off. And apparently the woods are full of dead birds, not for long, which of course the baboons were starving, come and eat them. And it's this feeling of irreparable damage being done ecologically, which is so painful. But this is not only a black tale, because I'm sorry for the pun. I mean, it's very also hopeful, because this country is so resilient in itself, its mood. It's so inventive and optimistic, that although, yeah, I could give you a whole string of disasters, and at the end I would still be optimistic, simply because they are so determined to make the place work.
Well, it's obvious you have a real affection for Zimbabwe. You first returned, I believe, in 1982, is that correct?
Mm.
1982. Was there any kind of culture shock after living abroad for so many years?
The culture shock was not realizing that the entire country would be in a state of psychosis that comes when the war's just ended, you know, because I saw it somewhere else. I saw it among the refugees and the fighters, the Afghan people. They were all shocked. They were war shocked, the whole country. And that was, it was very depressing then. But all that disappeared. Now you've got a generation who doesn't remember the war, you see. They don't know what you're talking about. It's past history.
In American Laughter, it's actually almost like a diary, a series of, well, I guess, sketches, a term we don't use very much, although you use them in the other new book that you have, The Real Thing, Stories and Sketches. When you talk about a sketch, that reminds me of something from the 19th century, in a way, where sketches would appear in a newspaper. It's kind of unusual, because we think of stories with short story will have a marginal plot or something, but a sketch doesn't, it's just an observation, isn't it? So you have a series of sketches or observations on these four visits that you made. And it's interesting that you really went into the heart of the country, into the, you describe the toilet facilities and things like that, and how people learn to use them. It's very, very difficult. You describe the health. Well, you had an automobile accident. That's an interesting story. Tell me about that.
Well, I was with four other people, actually members of my family, though I don't make a point of it, and a whole busload of extremely exuberant police off to the football match turned without signaling. And anyway, God knows why we were not all killed. And so we found ourselves in this hospital, little baby hospital. The thing was that there was a black doctor and the black nurses were very worried that we were not going to allow ourselves to be examined by a black doctor. Now, that was 1982. That wouldn't happen now. This kind of thing, it was, and the nurses were always watchful in case that they were suddenly going to find this racial prejudice. And the black policeman who wanted to learn from me how to write a novel. I mean, this is one of the great bizarre experiences of my life. There we were, bleeding, bandaged, my head was like Vesuvius, and there was this charming young black policeman who ought to have been taking down the notes of the accident so as to report it, which of course never happened, saying, I've had this interesting, sad life. Please tell me how I can write a novel about it. And I was saying, well, you see, it's like this. And everyone was around, I can imagine, what the hell does she think she's doing here? We ought to be taking down the notes of the accident. So then I went on, I told him how to write his novel, and he said, well, I will look upon you as my mother for always. Mm-hmm. And then we were driven off. And, of course, this accident was not reported because it was the fault of the police who had done it. That was then. I don't think that would happen now either. It was the country is very law-abiding now, and it's got a very solid base, a very solid, this word infrastructure, which I hate so much, but you find yourself using. I was told the other day that President Nyerere said to President Kaunda, right at the very beginning, said to him, you've inherited one of the jewels of Africa. Now, mind you, keep it as it ought to be. And you know it is. Of all the countries in that part, it is the successful one, despite of everything, despite the drought, despite incompetence, corruption. This place works, and it's full of people who want to make it work. I've ignored Botswana, but there are only a million people in it, you know. It would be very sad if Zimbabwe were allowed to go down the drain, simply because it, I mean, South Africa is in a state of total chaos, as you know. God knows what's going to happen to it. All the countries around about are war-torn or drought-torn or not working. But Zimbabwe's working.
There's another phrase that is used in African laughter. If I recall it correctly, I think it's called taking the gap. Mm. Is that correct? Can you tell me about that?
No. Somebody said they'd just gone to research it. A journalist who interviewed me said he'd gone to try and find out. There is no... nobody knows where taking the gap came from, but at that time everyone who left southern Rhodesia to go south, took the gap. And it was a term of great contempt, of course, because you were betraying the white side if you left.
That means going to South Africa or going to another country. But a lot of people came back. They found it was worse there.
Well, South Africa's 1,000 times worse than Zimbabwe. For one thing, race relations are rather good in Zimbabwe. I'm told in South Africa that they are very bad indeed. They're not in Zimbabwe. It's a pretty amiable country. Generally, and pleasant, and I'm not saying that there's no racism, you know, but God forbid, because it wouldn't be true. But there is not that edge of hatred on it. There might be, they're very comic people, the Africans, that part. They've got a marvelous sense of humor, they're very witty. So there might be quite an edge on something they say, but it's not ugly, ever.
When you return to Zimbabwe, what kind of relationship do you have with other whites in that country? Do they look upon you with any degree of hostility or suspicion, or skepticism?
Well, you know that most of the ones who would be likely to disapprove of me most have gone. They've gone to South Africa or other places like Australia, which is a very racist country, home from home. But the whites, there are only 100,000 whites left in Zimbabwe, and of those many are expats who are there on various do-gooding missions. And when I'm there, you see, you can meet such a variety of people in such a short time. Like the time before last, I was on the Roman Catholic circuit for nearly 10 days, which was a great surprise to me because...
What does that mean?
Well, I happened to meet up with a lady called Sister Dominica who very kindly took me, who's running one of these organizations to provide teachers from, mostly from this country, from states to teach, and usually in very tough places in Zimbabwe. I went with her and a friend of hers, Father Hackett, to visit missions and schools out in the bush and found myself listening to people who didn't have a good word to say about the Pope, which really surprised me. You know, who would have foreseen this? And then I was with a team of people making books for use in the rural areas for a couple of weeks, which was a complete switch, believe me, of mood and tone and tempo. This was a kind of revolutionary people, but without the politics, absolutely uninterested in politics. But trying to provide rural people who haven't had proper education the know-how to live in this technological society. Then I would go to the university, Ambiance in Harare, which is something else again, and or down to the white verandas, the white farms, which you wonder if any of them have changed. Well, they have changed a bit.
Last time you were here, you had just published in paperback a book about Afghanistan, where you had gone, and that was, I think, during the height of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Have you been monitoring events? What's happening there? Are you planning to go back at all?
No.
Or is it quiet enough that we can forget about it?
Well, it's, as you know, the setup now is that the Afghan commanders are not getting on, and the chief villain is one Hekmatyar, who is a fundamentalist, who only would exist because your country in its great wisdom chose him to support and funneled arms and money into this crook who won't cooperate with any of the others. I'm not saying that he's the only intransigent commander, but They would have got on by now without Hekmatyar. So, and the other problem about going back is that in the last year, the Soviet Union sowed the country from one end to another with bombs. And they people going back to their villages. You know those personnel bombs designed to blow hands and legs off? There are literally millions of these bombs all over Afghanistan. So, that before people can go back, they have to get rid of the bombs. And that is a fairly long and expensive business.
What is the distinction for you between fiction and nonfiction, or is there none?
Interesting you should ask that, because I'm trying to write my autobiography at the moment, and I notice that all the time I have to stop myself. It's so natural for me to go off.
Make it up, you mean?
Yes, I have to stop myself the whole time to from inventing. It's very difficult. It's so much more fun to invent, isn't it?
Well, I was reading this biography. I was reading Langston Hughes' autobiography some time ago, and later I read a biography of Langston Hughes by someone, a scholar who really knew his work. And it turns out that Langston Hughes' autobiography is almost a pure fabrication. He invented dates, he invented people, changed names, created episodes and incidents that never occurred. Completely unreliable. That was Langston Hughes, a fiction writer and poet. And it is easy, I guess, in a way, easy or maybe more fun to kind of twist things to make them come out the way you imagine that they should.
Well, I'm trying very hard to stick to fact. And where I have changed things, I say so. I say, change names here or something. And I have no doubt a biographer would... I'm making no attempt whatsoever to sit down and do research, you know, because after 30 years, you're not going to remember what exact date something happened, you know. Who would? I'm just putting down what I remember and also what I make of it, because one can look at any given event in many different ways, after all. And you do, you know, the way you look at something when you're 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, it's different every time.
How's Jane Summers doing?
Well, Jane Summers did extremely well unexpectedly in France and in Spain and in Italy and the Scandinavian countries. I can't remember about Germany. Germany took The Fifth Child to its heart. I did very well. It was on the bestseller list for a long time. You can never predict what's going to happen with a book.
You're going to have to come up with a new pseudonym.
Well, I don't think I've got time. Getting on, aren't I? I think I've got things I want to finish.
Well, your autobiography first, I guess.
Huh? I think I can only write Vol 1. I don't see how I can write Vol 2. Because after I got to England, I became involved almost at once with, I've known quite a lot of very well-known people. I don't understand how people write about. I think I just can't write Volume 2.
What do you mean you got involved with a number of people?
Well, I know a lot of things about people that I wouldn't really like to say, you know. Why should one let out the dirt about everyone? I don't see it's my job.
Well, you can do what H.L. Mencken did. He released his memoirs 30 years after his death.
Well, that is a possibility. I think I might write it and say, you can sit on it until everyone's dead.
That's no fun, because then you can't enjoy it.
I should enjoy the writing of it.
Like Emily Dickinson, she never published in her lifetime, a poet, New England poet. After her death, they found volumes of poetry she wrote. Well, that's no fun for her.
Well, you're looking at it in a way I'm sure she wouldn't look at it. She would say, well, the writing of the poetry is the fun.
Yeah, but also isn't the aim of a writer to share your words and to share your point of view, feelings and emotions?
Well, I'm very keen on Volume 1, I really am, partly because that whole society is gone, you know, to the extent where my own children, when I tell them things about how things were, they're absolutely astounded. And that's only one generation after me. So I'm very glad to, I really enjoy describing how things used to be. There are all kinds of things that have disappeared as if they never were.
Now, have you kept a journal or diary over all these years?
I've kept a journal for the last 25 or 30 or so. No, I do remember. I've got a very good memory in certain areas. And that's what I write about other people. You know, biographers make things up very often. This is really why I'm writing an autobiography. At least I'll write the truth about what I know, and I might have asterisks where I say, well, this is almost the truth, but not quite. Because
this is the truth as I see it. But isn't it interesting, when you're a kid, or at least when I was a kid, I don't know if they do it today, during the holidays, during Christmas or something like that, your parents would give you a diary. You usually would have a little lock on it, a key. And I must have had 5 or 6 of these diaries over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I would start, you know, and the first page would be long, and the second page would not be quite as long, and the third page would be even shorter, and so forth. And I would just kind of peter out. Then a year or two later, I'd be given a new diary, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an uncle or an aunt would give me the diary, and I'd start it again. And never kept it up. This would be a wonderful thing for people to do if they only did it, you know, because that way you would actually have a date. Even if you just made a list. This is what I did today. I saw my broker, I met my editor, I saw my agent, I did an interview. You know, wouldn't that shock your memory if it just even had just a list of things you did each day?
Yes, it would, because I find looking back even 5 years ago, I'm astounded. What I was thinking, never mind what I did. But as you say, I don't have a diary going back far enough. But when you talk about a diary, you're making good resolutions. What happened with me was I often said I should keep a diary, but I never did. I suddenly found that my little baby one-page-a-day diary was crammed with minute writing. I thought, I am keeping a diary. So I got a bigger diary, and a bigger diary till I reached a two-page-a-day diary. Crammed. Suddenly I discover that it's not crammed at all. It's just getting less and less and less. In other words, resolutions are not worth anything. You do it or you don't do it.
Well, I found a way. I'm now keeping a diary, but I found an easy way to do it. I have a computer.
Ah.
And so I just tap in. And when I first started it, though, I would try to tap in my innermost feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized I didn't have that many innermost feelings. So now what I do, tonight when I go home, I'll type in 1 o'clock, interview Doris Lessing. 4 o'clock, did phone interview with Governor Cuomo. 5 o'clock, met so-and-so for a drink. You know, so I'll just make a list of things like that. Occasionally, if I get upset, I get into a fight with someone, you know, then I'll put that down a little bit, but it would have been a wonderful thing to look back at my childhood. And nobody would care about this. I mean, this would have to be the most boring thing in the world for anybody. It's just for me, you know. And just like your journal is probably just for you and how you use it is something else. But wouldn't it be interesting to look back at what you did when you were 7, 6, the people you saw and the things you did?
Yes, it would. But I remember bits with immense clarity. And they just, well, everybody remembers bits of immense clarity, and then there are the dark bits in between.
I have a theory about that that maybe you can comment on. These things that you remember with great clarity are usually the first things like that ever happened to you.
Hmm.
When you're a child, well, for example, I remember the first fire I covered as a young journalist. I remember very few fires after that. I mean, they just a blur to me, but the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Is unique, and so it's and in fact, my car burned up in that fire.
Mm-hmm.
The fireman couldn't get the car out of the way of this raging fire that spread through a factory. I mean, it was vivid to me. And as a child, you remember things that happened to you, good things or bad things, because they're the first things that happened to you. And these are all traumas that we get over. When you're older, I can't remember what I did last week. Too well.
I try and remember what I did last week.
But doesn't that make sense at all?
Yes, it does. I think you're right. But what is interesting is not only the first things that happen, but why should something make an impression on you so you remember it 60 or 70 years later, some scenes that are, they're not necessarily the first things. Things that you remember somebody's face or a moment between adults when they're giving themselves away or...
Odors.
Oh, very strong, yes.
Odors. Sometimes
absolutely.
I can almost smell them again.
Mm. Oh, they're very strong. There's nothing like smells, is it?
Well, Doris Lessing, it was wonderful having you back. Two beautiful new books by Doris Lessing, African Laughter and The Real Thing. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.